Welcome back to the Freedom Report podcast. I'm your host, Austin Peterson, and today's special guest is Steve Horwitz. He's an Austrian economist, which a lot of you must know about if you're fans of this show, and he's a professor at St. Lawrence University. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Austin. Always good to be here.
Good to see you, too. Professor, yesterday I sent you an article that had a title. It was pretty shocking to a lot of people, not to me and probably not to you, but to a lot of people. The story was called, "Which country has the second largest social welfare system in the world?" Surely not the U.S. of the poor, eh? Actually, yes. It turns out that as a percentage of GDP, the U.S. spends the second most on welfare. Rubber monkeys, the French. So, did people really not know this, or is everyone as stupid as Jonathan Gruber said? As we are, Steve.
Well, we're not as stupid as Jonathan Gerber says we are, that's for sure. I think the bigger question, though, is, you know, do people know this? Do people not know this? I mean, we do have a big welfare state. I just think one of the things as I looked at that piece was, the point of that piece, in many ways, was depends how you calculate it, right? If you calculate by looking at all the kinds of programs that the U.S. provides, and if you look at, you know, both at the federal and the state level and a variety of different things, yeah, I mean, we do provide a lot of assistance for the poor. And to my recollection, I didn't look at it again this morning, but one of the things that article didn't talk about, it focused on welfare programs. Of course, Americans are more charitable than the rest of the world too, right? So when we think in terms of helping the poor, if you want to meaningfully talk about helping the poor, you better talk about charity too.
Absolutely. Good point there. All right. So my next question on this would be, you know, how have people who are below the poverty line been faring in recent years?
Well, you know, complicated, of course, by the last five and the Great Recession. But I think if we sort of go back, say, a generation or two since the 70s or 80s or 90s, in fact, poor Americans have done really well in sort of absolute standard of living. If we look at the kinds of things we typically see in poor households today, poor Americans have cell phones. Poor Americans are almost as likely to own refrigerators, freezers, basic appliances as are the average American family or wealthy Americans. So, you know, by the ability of what they're able to consume and have in their households, poor Americans have done increasingly well in the last several decades and are slowly catching up to the rest of us.
All right, now I want to ask you a question, and I want you to answer this objectively. Would you rather be poor in Europe or poor in the United States?
Well, from the evidence that we have anyway, you're better off being poor in the United States. If you look at the sort of in general, if you look at the average consumption rates in most European countries, they actually look like the consumption rates or ability to consume in poorer U.S. states. So even poor, you know, if we start to then start thinking about, well, what does it mean to be poor in those countries? Part of the problem in general in those countries, they don't have the consumption opportunities that we have. So if you're going to be poor, you might as well be, I think you're better off being poor in the United States. Stuff is cheaper. Between the kinds of things that article addresses in terms of state help and private help, you're being poor in America is certainly less treacherous than I think being poor in other parts of the world. Again, just the overall level of economic development in the United States is certainly part of that.
One of the points that's raised in the article is how progressive the United States tax system is compared to Europe. What does that mean? I thought we were supposed to be we hate the poor and our taxes are way too low over here. But this article seems to say that we have one of the most progressive income tax rates in the whole world. What is that all about?
Yeah, I think, you know, what part of the argument is that there's a difference between the sort of overall level of taxation and how progressive it is. That is, if by progressive, how much different is the rates paid by the poor and paid by the wealthy, then there is a pretty good gap in the United States. It may be that our overall levels of taxation are lower, but just that gap is bigger. So we look at other countries, we see a higher overall or a higher average level of taxation, but the progressivity there is greater. Or is less, rather. So yeah.
No, I'm not an economist, Steve. I rely on people like you. I read your work, your blog. By the way, what's the name of your blog?
Coordination Problem.
Coordination Problem. So
Bleeding Heart Libertarians, yes.
And Bleeding Heart Libertarians. I encourage my listeners to check that out. But I get a little. I'm smart enough to get a little suspicious when I read things like, if you define poverty as not having much when other people have a lot of material goods, then yes, the poor people in America have it badly. And I think to myself, does that mean that people think that you're poor just because you don't have as much as someone else? And is that really a good way to measure poverty?
Yeah, I think there's a couple interesting questions in there, Austin. Let me tell you a quick story about that. And your listeners are probably familiar with The Grapes of Wrath, right? The Steinbeck novel of the Great Depression that sort of depicted U.S. poverty in the Great Depression. This family tribes gets in their car and has to go west and goes through all these horrible travails. Well, the Soviets showed the film version of Grapes of Wrath as propaganda in the 1940s, right? So this look at how terrible it is in the United States. And they had to stop after a week or two because the Russian audiences would watch it and go, well, wait a second, poor Americans have a car? So there is this debate about relative and absolute poverty. And so when we talk, just as you're saying, right, we can define poverty in relative terms and say, well, in a world like the United States, if you don't have X, Y, and Z, you're therefore poor. Or we can just talk in absolute terms and we can say, how able are people to survive? The fact that the vast majority of poor American households have a refrigerator, a freezer, a TV, and all these kind of basic appliances, and air conditioning in a car, suggest in absolute terms, certainly compared to the rest of the world, they're doing pretty well. One last thing to think about too, right? Through most of human history, the difference between rich and poor were difference between people who had stuff and people who didn't, right? Haves and have-nots. In the West today, the U.S., Western, isn't have or have not, it's have more and better versus just have a few. So for example, Bill Gates has cars, I have a car, right? Bill Gates has more, they're probably better, but we both have cars. We can both travel on an airplane. We both are not, starving for food. For most Americans, our lives aren't that much different. And if you walk through a mall or an airport, you can't tell who the rich people are and who the poor are. 200, 300, 500 years ago, not that. So that's a huge advance for poor people today if we look in the long run.
Yeah, well, when I see someone with a Valenti jacket and, and a $1,500 coat and shirt, I sure as hell know, because I get jealous and I'm like, how do I get the money? How did they get that money?
But then you go to a Dallas Mavericks game and there's Mark Cuban sitting in his T-shirt and jeans in the front row, right? You wouldn't know. You saw him on the street, you wouldn't know.
Oh, whatever. You hate poor people.
Yeah.
All right. So, I want to talk about things in terms of marketing, but I only want to stay on that for a second because I want to get back to economics, because your whole thing is, it's the bleeding heart of libertarians. We need to talk about, these issues from a way that will make drive empathy, give libertarians a sense of empathy, which libertarians tend to not be very good at. Mm-hmm. But there's a quote by Benjamin Franklin where he talks about how we should make the poor uncomfortable to drive them out of poverty, which is a very sort of conservative Republican lift yourselves up by your bootstraps thing. It's kind of the opposite of a bleeding heart libertarian approach. So, I mean, do you think that that's the wrong way to look at it, that we want to sort of make them poor people uncomfortable in their poverty?
I think there's two. I mean, the challenge is there's two things going on at once, right? I mean, there's ways in which government policies have made it unduly burdensome on poor people to get out of that poverty, whether it's the way welfare destroys incentives, whether it's the way occupational licensure and minimum wage laws destroy that. I mean, so there's the way in which government has really made victims of the poor. On the other hand, it's also true, as you say, right, once those artificial barriers are out of the way, let's encourage people to work hard. Let's encourage people to build themselves up by their own bootstraps, right? That I think that rhetoric is okay. We just have to recognize that rhetoric isn't enough when there are real structural barriers in the way of the poor improving themselves.
Yeah, and if liberals like me, then you know how they respond to emotional arguments. I've been debating this socialist Tom Hartman on Russian television for the last few years, and it's always this outrage and stuff like that. So I quit talking about the numbers, Steve, because I realize that a lot of people just don't care. They just want you to empathize with them. They want you to feel, I think that a big problem with the debate nowadays is true that on a lot of our sides we do come off a bit uncaring, as not empathic. But the problem is there, and this is a psychology problem, and I'll just say this and then we can move on. The psychology problem is that, we get rewards for telling our in-group, hey, the things that they want to hear, and demonizing the left and demonizing the other, And so we sort of get a reward, at least I know for sure, because it's like for me, it's like when I write an article that bashes Obama, bashes liberals, confirms my group thinking, then we all get sort of excited and happy and everybody pats me on the back. But when I question the groupthink, or when I act and I talk with empathy about the plight of minorities and inner cities and things like that, then my in-group gets angry, and the out-group Only they still don't like me.
Right. Well, right, and I think part of that is we're not very good at distinguishing between ends and means, right? I mean, in not all cases, but the disagreements often with our friends on the left are not because we don't think poor people should be better off, or not because we don't think, we want to see certain results. We just disagree about how to get there, right? And I think that's, we can make our arguments with that kind of empathy or that recognition that we care about the same things, but we got to try to also make the, soft hearts but hard heads, right? That we have to be serious about the real world incentives and the real world processes that generate wealth and that lift people out of poverty, even as we talk about how important it is to care about those things.
Okay, good point. All right, so away from the marketing of this message, yep, and back onto the numbers. So, Professor, a lot of people have argued in the last 30 years that we've seen this great stagnation, they call it, in terms of household earnings. Is that the case?
It's a statistical mirage in some sense, right? I mean, if you look at median household income, it has leveled off, and in fact, gone down the last few years. But falling median household income doesn't mean necessarily that anyone's getting poorer, right? I mean, if you'll bear with me for a second, imagine I give a test to 5 students and, they score 67, it's a 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. The median there is 70. Suppose the next test, every one of them does 5 points better, but 2 new students have entered the class and they score really low. They're going to drag the median down, but no one who took the first test is any worse off than the second test, right? So as population growth takes place, as immigration takes place, as people come into the labor market, if they come in at the bottom, that can drag a median down even though nobody else is getting poorer. So if we want to talk about stagnation, we have to look at, again, this kind of data on what are the real lived lives of poor and middle class folks like. What's in their houses? What can they consume? What are they able to do? How long do they live? Right? These are the questions that we need to ask, not just looking at those statistics, which are sort of unintended consequences, epiphenomena of these other processes.
Interesting. Okay. Now, Professor, this is where I speak about our in-group in a manner in which they will not be pleased. There's been a lot of gloom and doom on the economy coming from economists and politicians in our camp, especially since the financial crisis of 2008 when the Fed pumped, trillions of dollars in the economy. And the Austrians have been predicting hyperinflation and a dollar crisis for a year. So tell me, Mr. Austrian economist, where's the inflation?
Okay, well let's get one thing clear first. Who what do we mean by Austrians here, right? I mean the investor guru types maybe, okay? But there's no academic Austrian economist who said anything like hyperinflation or things like that. I mean, people like Bob Murphy predicted higher levels of inflation. If you find some old interviews with me back then, I said it wouldn't surprise me if we saw double digits in 5 years. So again, that's not hyperinflation. That's not a dollar crisis. That's comparable to the 1970s inflation. So did we really predict disaster? Maybe Peter Schiff, maybe some crazy people on the internet, but not the serious people. That said,
they're still out there, Steve.
They are. So how do we explain? How do we understand what happened? Well, I think the answer to that is, I think people underestimated the degree to which the new money that the Fed was creating, the additions to what we call the monetary base, we underestimated the degree to which banks simply wouldn't lend those out. I mean, all that money the Fed created is sitting in the banks' deposit accounts that they keep at the Fed. Banks aren't lending. And, you can talk about why they're not lending, which might be terrible economic policy by the Obama administration, political uncertainty, the problems with Obamacare. There's all kinds of reasons why they might not be lending, one of which, by the way, is the Fed now pays them interest on those reserves, which it didn't before 2008. So banks can just sit on that money and earn a quarter point. It doesn't sound like much, but when it's billions, pretty soon you're talking real money. So that's one option. So for all these reasons, all that newly created stuff the Fed was generating is just sitting in banks. So it hasn't entered the spending stream. We haven't seen prices go up. Question is, what happens to it now, right? Mm. And so what the mystery is how the Fed's going to undo this, right? How the Fed is going to either get that stuff out of there or somehow how it's going to enter the – if it ever enters the spending stream, how it does it without generating inflation, not clear. They've painted themselves into a corner, so I don't know how they're going to get out of it. But we haven't seen it yet because it's just sitting in – banks are sitting on it. The time bomb's ticking, though.
Interesting. All right. Now, I could make a lot more money and be a lot more popular amongst libertarians if I just push the dollar crisis all the time, but I've got to be objective.
It sells books and newsletters, no question about that.
Sure as hell does. All right. So last question here, and this is back to, I think, universal relevance for the most part. It's a new study by the National Bureau of Economic Research today comes out. It shows that the employment for low-skilled workers falls as the minimum wage goes up. So it's I guess my question for this is it's psychological. Is part of the problem with this that the people who are least likely to understand economics are the ones who are going to be the most harmed by pushing these progressive policies that hurt themselves?
I think in some cases, yeah. I mean, but it's also the case that the intellectual elite doesn't understand economics and often confuses good intentions with good results, right? So you know, well, of course, if we pass a law that says McDonald's workers are going to get $15 an hour, then they're going to get $15 an hour. Well, no, actually, they're not. So yeah, it's true often. I mean, I think it is the case that people vote for bad economic policies that harm themselves because they just don't understand the process of it. I mean, this is sort of a Brian Kaplan point. But I also think there's people for whom it's not about them, but whose understanding of economics is also bad, or at least for whom either intentions are more important than results or signaling is more important, right? We're talking about in-group and out-group. If all you care about is signaling to your in-group that you care, as my friend the philosopher Dave Schmidt says, if what you're concerned mostly, if you're mostly concerned about your heart being in the right place, it isn't, right? Okay, so that's, and I think that's a great line, and that really captures, I think, what Bleeding Heart Libertarians are trying to say, which is it's not about signaling, it's not about caring, it's about what do the policies actually do, what harms poor people, what helps poor people. Let's focus on that.
Fantastic. All right, so, Professor, people can find more out about your work. They can go to Bleeding Heart Libertarians.
Bleeding Heart Libertarians, coordination problem. They can follow me on Facebook. Both. They can follow my regular page. They can go to my public figure page and give that a like, too. So I got 5,000 friends, but you can always follow.
That's true. We'll make sure that we link to you over at the Libertarian Republic. Hopefully you'll get a bunch of new fans and followers out of this. Professor Horowitz, thank you very much for your time. And
always a pleasure, Austin.
Have a good one.